Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is the 22nd podcast I've recorded. I'm recording it on October 11th of 2008. My usual practice is just to give the month when I record these things, but stock prices have been changing so fast of late that I need to give the day. The PE 10 level today is 15. This is a Saturday. 15 means we are at fair value. Stocks have been dangerously overpriced for over 10 years now. And people who look at the historical data, rational investors, people who understand that valuations affect long-term returns and that the price you pay for stocks affects the long-term value proposition, have been warning that stocks are dangerous for over 10 years now. That is not true. And at least in an objective numerical sense today, stocks are not dangerous today. Stocks offer a strong long-term value proposition today at a PE 10 level of 15. There are dangers that always apply. The danger is that stocks are always volatile, and the fact that they're at fair value doesn't mean they're going to fall very hard from today's levels. Stocks could certainly fall another 50%, so you need to be prepared for that. But if you are a long-term investor, the odds were against you when prices were at those insane levels where they were until recently. Because even if prices went up a little bit in the short term, we knew that they would be going down hard in the long term. The opposite is the case today. Even if stocks were to fall hard in the short term, if you are able to hold for 10 years, the odds favor you strongly that you will obtain a good return from your stock investment. So that situation has been turned around. The name of this podcast is Are You Woman Enough for Rational Investing? That's an odd title, isn't it? And this title was prompted by a number of things. Partly it's prompted by the price crash. There were some reactions to that. You know, people have been putting up items in the news. The loss to middle class investors is $8 trillion over the past 12 months. That's a shocking number. I think we should call this the passive investing crash. Passive investing caused this. There will be people that don't like it that I say that, but that's the reality. Passive investing caused this stock market crash. When stocks go to dangerously high levels, they always crash. There are no exceptions in the historical record. This is the fourth time we've tried going to such dangerous levels. The first three times we saw stock market crashes, we're now in the process of seeing the fourth stock market crash caused by going to dangerously high prices. And in every case, dangerously high stock prices are not rational. If investors were rational when prices got dangerous, investors would lower their stock allocations, and that would pull prices down to reasonable levels. So it is impossible to have the valuation levels we've seen over the past 10 years without stock investing becoming an extremely emotional endeavor. And passive investing is the model of understanding how stocks work that caused people to become so emotional. Stock investing is the model that says you don't need to worry about high prices. You can stick with your high stock allocation even when prices get wildly out of control. That obviously defies common sense. It defies the academic research of the past 20 years, which has discredited the efficient market theory, which is the intellectual framework for the passive investing model. And it defies the historical data the historical stock return data dating back to 1870. There's never been a time in history when this passive investing idea has worked out in the real world. So, but we've been getting comments over the past day or two. I've been posting it, and people have been quoting these comments to me. They're telling investors don't panic, and I find this, I'm not sure what the word is. I find it insulting to middle-class investors. Patronizing, maybe? Panic is obviously not a good thing. Tell me a person who's going to say, I disagree. Panic, we should panic. Panic is good. No one's going to say that panic is a good thing. So we don't need experts parading out and telling us not to panic. What we need are experts who will give us the information we need to avoid getting ourselves in circumstances when we would feel like panicking. Make sense? That's what we need. We need people that will tell us the straight story so that, if everyone understood that price levels were so dangerous, that a stock crash was inevitable, there wouldn't be any panic about it. Everyone would just say, I knew that was going to happen. And most of us, of course, would have lowered our stock allocations, anyone with sense. And if there were a few crazy people who didn't, well, that's gambling. And, gamblers understand they can lose their money. There are people that go to Las Vegas and they gamble and they lose money and they don't whine about it or complain or panic. And that's what any investors who continue to, putting a high percentage of their portfolio in stocks at the prices that have applied in recent years would have done, had only they known. But the situation we have is that we were not told it was gambling. We were told, this is fine. This is responsible. This is prudent. This is what the experts say. So, I find it offensive for people to now come out, the very people who have been telling us to do this, to come out now and tell us not to panic. When, we've lost money that took us years to save. We've lost life opportunities. So the joke is not funny to my ears. So that's, that was part of it. And that got me a little stirred up. And then I read a letter to the editor at John Walter Russell's site. John Walter Russell has the most exciting website on the internet. It's early-retirement-planning-insights.com. John does all the research for the calculators that are at my website and at his website. And John has a letter to the editor's section of the site, which is a great section of his site. And there's a guy named Wayne who put up a letter, and it was very interesting. He made some very interesting points, because Wayne is a rational investor. Wayne buys into the idea that you need to look at valuations when buying stocks. But he made several comments about me and in particular my podcast. He said he had listened to the first 14 of them. And, I give the guy a lot of credit for that. If you listen to 14, I said in my response, if you listen to 14 in my podcast, you're my friend. I don't care what else you say. He had some criticisms. And one was that I am repetitive in the podcast. And that one, I think there's a lot of truth to. Each podcast has a different focus. They're not all identical. But there's no question but that there are a couple of themes that I just ram home over and over and over again. And, I've said myself that my mantra is valuations affect long-term returns. I say it over and over again. And the other thing that I am a bulldog on is passive investing doesn't work. Those two themes. And, I hope they're not overly repetitive. I hope there are new things in the podcast, but to a large extent, they are repetitive by intent, because I spend a lot of time thinking about why is it that passive investing is so popular. You know, I know that passive investing is wrong. I settled that one in my mind years ago. So I know that. I you know, none of us ever know anything with 100% certainty, but let's put it at 99.999%. I know that passive investing does not work to the same degree that I know that the moon is not made of green cheese. I know that. But yet, it's clearly popular. You know, it's phenomenally popular. And it's popular and accepted. Some people would say, oh, you know, a different person who's experienced what I've experienced would say, people are dumb. You know, why don't they get it? But I know a lot of the people. You know, I post with people on discussion boards, and you get to know people over time. And I know that a lot of the people that accept passive investing are not dumb. I know that for a fact. So that explanation just doesn't work. So I cross that one off my list. And then, you know, you might say, well, the case isn't strong enough. And at one time, that might have been the explanation I would have gone with. I learned that passive investing doesn't work in stages. And at one point, I had a, you know, reasonable confidence that was so, but I wasn't certain. And I might have said, well, the case isn't so terribly strong that it would persuade everyone. But now, the case is overwhelming. I can cite, you know, a million different things. So it's not that the case isn't strong, and it's not that the people are not intelligent enough. What is it? And it's emotion. That's my short answer to the question. Passive investing has emotional appeal. But the other thing is, it's not just emotion, because I've seen people express interest in learning about new ideas. I've seen a lot of that. So why don't they pursue those ideas and change? And there, I think the big thing is that what the experts tell them really affects people. People are really intimidated by expertise in the investing area. People really feel that they just don't know enough to dare to disagree with the experts. I think that's the biggest thing. And another thing is that people want feedback from their friends that they're doing the right thing. People would almost rather do the wrong thing and have a lot of company doing it than to do the right thing and do it alone. And I think you have to chalk that up to human nature. So what that tells me is that the solution, you know, the way to bring passive investing down and bring rational investing up is as a community. You don't do it by being a lone wolf and saying, you know, here are all my reasons. Here's my box full of reasons. Nobody cares about your box full of reasons. But as a community, people do care. People want to learn. So we need to do this as a community. We need to sort of help each other. I feel strongly about that. You know, when I talk about the question was the repetition. Why are the podcast repetitious? And one of the things I've come to believe, I've looked a lot about how do people come to learn things, how do people come to believe things. And one of the things I've come to believe, what they've done with passive investing is, you know, there was a guy at the Vanguard Diehards board who said he worked on Wall Street, and he said passive investing was developed in the marketing departments of Wall Street. And I think that's right. And what they do in marketing is, you know, they come up with slogans. And the slogans have to be plausible, or people wouldn't, you know, if a slogan was the moon is made of green cheese, it wouldn't convince anybody. So the slogan has to be, you know, it has to be pitched properly. And that's what all of these slogans are, the passive investing slogans. You know, timing doesn't work. It sounds plausible. Sounds like you're telling somebody something responsible when you tell them that. Sounds like you're protecting them. You know, you say timing doesn't work. It sounds like you're being a parent and you're guiding them away from danger. Well, just the opposite is true. It's because people did not time the market. If people had lowered their stock allocations when prices got dangerous, they would have been timing the market and they would have saved themselves from this $8 trillion loss. But they made it sound like they were being responsible when really they were selling snake oil. So, but the repetition gets to people. They hear it so many times and they think there's got to be some truth to it. It can't just be crazy talk. There's got to be truth to it. So, you know, I try to fight the battle using the same weapons. I feel that I have to have, I don't know that I have slogans, but maybe I do. Maybe I need to. But I think repetition is important, actually. Now, if somebody, you know, Wayne agrees with me on the main point. So if you agree, I can see how it might get a little annoying that a person keeps making the same point. But my sense is that there are a lot of people today who still don't understand why passive investing doesn't work. So I see it as my job to lay out the foundation as well as I can and as often as I can, and to be sure to address every possible objection. So there is an element of repetition. But the other point made by Wayne was that he used the word that, you know, was unusual. He said, Rob sounds wounded. And I don't think I'm wounded, but there's a sense in which it's true. Greatly saddened, greatly pained by the destruction of so many discussion boards. Those people were my friends. Those people are people I learned from. All the work at my website is greatly influenced by community members who have contributed ideas without receiving any compensation whatsoever. So these people are heroes in my eyes. And I've talked with thousands of people who have expressed a desire to learn about the realities of investing. And it pains me that they can't have their questions answered, that they've been silenced. So yes, and you know, I see the potential as being so huge, and there's no upside to the abuse of posting. None. It hurts. It helps no one. The goon posters hurt themselves by not learning the realities of investing. So when I see how high we can go and how low we have fallen, yes, there's, you know, I don't know. Wounded is not the word I would use, but pained, I would say I'm pained. And certainly there's pain in seeing that people have lost so many life opportunities with the loss of $8 trillion of wealth in 1 year. So there's some of that there. But I wanted to explore a little bit what Wayne was getting at and why. Wayne is not the only person that has raised this idea. And the other one he raised, he said that some of my discussions are vague. What he wants is very specific instructions for what to do as an investor, and I don't always give that. And I've heard that from a number of people. I get emails saying that. And I even wrote an article one time at the site. It was called The How-To of Valuation-Informed Indexing, something like that. And the article was sort of flat. It didn't excite me. And I was trying to respond to those emails. And I think the problem is valuation-informed indexing is not... It's different. It's different from passive investing. People want it to be. People are used to seeing things through this passive investing lens, and when they see rational investing or valuation informed indexing, it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit their expectations, and that bothers them, and it makes it harder for me to sell. It makes it harder for me to make my pitch. But more and more over time, I am resistant to the idea of trying to fit the passive investing model because I think that model's a disaster. So I reject that model wholesale. I just reject it from the ground up. Another case of this that that really hit me hard was Michael Kitsis. He's a financial planner, and I exchanged a lot of emails with Michael, and they've been posted at my blog, and you can read the text of those. If you search for Michael Kitsis there at the blog, you'll find them. There's a good number of them. And Michael, you know, he's a great guy, put forward a number of great emails. He's a warm guy, you know, friendly. And, I lost my thought, but trying to think back. Oh, we're talking about vagueness. Michael, at one point, you know, I talked to him about all the academics who have rejected if the efficient market theory / passive investing, you know, have discredited. And Michael said, yeah, you know, you're right, Rob. A lot of people have rejected it. A lot of people have discredited. But he said, we don't have another model to replace it with. So for the time being, we're sort of stuck. And I loved that comment because it's, you know, it sounds real to me. It sounds the way things work, the way the world really works. People don't think this model works. People know. I use the phrase gibberish. I say it's gibberish. Nobody else talks that way. Others will say, oh, there are, you know, it does not reflect reality in a perfect, idealistic way. You know, they go on and on with this talk. But the point is, it's gibberish. It's not the real world. It's nonsense. The world, the market is not efficient. Come on. An efficient market wouldn't cause $8 trillion of losses in 1 year. If the price was efficient back a year ago, it might have changed a little bit in the time since. We wouldn't have lost $8 trillion worth of work. $8 trillion worth of wealth. So, but we need a new model. You're not going to kick the old model out until you have something else that people can hang their hat on. So I've done my part to develop a new model. I call it rational investing. And so I told Michael that. I said, Michael, we're working on a model. And here's some, you know, I gave him some links to get a sense of what the model's about. And, you know, even when I wrote it, I felt it's not entirely persuasive what I'm saying, because I think what he wants to see is, oh, you know, he wants to look at some equation or something and say, Eureka, he's done it. He's solved the puzzle. This is what we've been looking for. But rational investing isn't like that. Rational investing is more, it's more a matter of perspective. It's how you look at investing. There is no one mathematical equation that proves it all. And that's what the passive investing people are looking for. They look at investing as an intellectual enterprise. And when something holds them back, what they do is they work harder at what they've already failed at. You know, and that's so human, so like a human. All of us do that. You know, have you ever seen somebody that, oh, let me think of an example. Say there's a guy who is brilliant at his job, and he's, you know, he's rising up the fast track, and he's making lots of money, and he's an unstoppable force. But you know the guy, you're his friend, and he hasn't had a date in 3 years, right? He doesn't have any social life. You know, and he's a nice guy, and he wants to date, he wants to be married, he wants to have kids. And you know this about him. But, you know, what's he do? He feels anxious about it from time to time. But what's he do? He says, well, I'm feeling anxious. I want to feel better. Hey, I'll write a memo on the Johnson Project, and everybody's going to applaud me. It's going to be the greatest memo. And he does that, and everybody does applaud him. But his old problem is still there. He still doesn't have a date. That happens all the time in a million different ways. Every single one of us is guilty of that from time to time. We play to our strengths. And it's not always wrong to play to your strengths, but sometimes it is. Sometimes you have to do the thing that's hard for you to do and you know, have growth and do it badly. You know, the guy could go on a date and it's a disaster, but that's a step up for him. Just doing it, even if it's a disaster, is a step up. And that means more in terms of his life growth than writing the Johnson memo and getting another promotion. But it sure is easy to turn his attention to writing the Johnson memo. So that's what, excuse me, that's what passive investors do. I see this all the time. When they feel challenged, they say, hey, let's do some calculations. And they jigger up their calculators, you know, and they got numbers coming into the machine and it's popping out answers. And it's all crazy talk. You know, all the answers are wildly off the mark, but boy, does it make them feel good. Boy, does it reassure them that they've got numbers to hold on to. Hey, we're right. And that's, of course, why we've had such resistance to, you know, we discovered back in May of 2002 that the old school safe withdrawal rate studies are wrong. All the retirement advice you've heard for the past 20 years is wrong because the safe withdrawal rate studies are wrong. And those studies influence just about everything you hear about retirement planning. But nobody's fixed the studies. Nobody wants to fix them. And because those studies reassure people. Passive investors, they say, oh, I'm worried about my retirement. Passive investing doesn't really make sense. Some of these academics have discredited it, you know. But hey, the safe withdrawal rate study says I'm doing all right. And they hug it close. That's the Johnson memo. They're fooling themselves. What they need to do is forget the darn old school safe withdrawal rate study and, you know, come up with a new model for retirement planning. Come up with something that works, something that makes sense. But that's scary. So that's, you know, all these ideas mixed in brought me to the title for this podcast. Are you woman enough for rational investing? And the point here is, passive investing is a macho game. Passive investing is a macho game. I've never heard anybody say that. You know, one of the things I do, I'm a writer, and as a writer, there are certain things you want to do. You want to produce quality material. You want to produce material that has practical value, if possible. You want to produce material that people like, and you want to produce new material, because if it's practical and people like it and it's quality, but there's a million other articles saying the same thing, not too many people are going to pay attention to what you wrote because there's just no need for it. So I'm always on the lookout for those things. Just, you know, as a reporter, you just instantly, you know, that's what you look for. You can't help it. And when I say something like passive investing is a macho game, the bell that rings in my head is nobody's ever said that before. The implications are huge. So it is important. And I believe I can do a quality job writing it up. Okay. That's a matter of, you know, opinion, but I believe that. So it's important. I can do quality work. Whether people or like it or not remains to be seen. Thus far, I haven't had too much success on that scale, but there are some people who just love my stuff, you know, and they're just, when people get it, they get it intensely. So that's a good sign. But some people hate it. That's for sure. But even when people hate it, that's sort of a good sign, reading it one way, because the intensity factor tells you that there's something important going on. You know, if they didn't respond that way, you might say it's boring. But there's nothing boring about what I say about passive investing. No way, no how is it boring. So it's new. So that statement, passive investing is a macho game. But it is. And it's one of the clues for why people have bought into it. As I say, one of the things, I wrote an article at the site on this theme. I don't remember the exact title. It was on Suze Orman, and it was called Boy Disease and How Suze Orman Helps. I think that's the title. I think it was under the Heroes and Villains section of the site. The point I tried to make there is that the personal finance area, it's mostly men. And it's not just men, it's a particular type of man that works this field. Analytical men. And, you know, I'm all for it. I'm all for being analytical. But it's even a particular personality type. And you know, if you're familiar with the Myers-Briggs personality assessment tool, they have four letters. I can't describe it all. It would take too long. But they have four letters that they assign to each personality type. There are 16 personality types in all under Myers-Briggs. And I think they do an excellent job of describing how different people operate. And, you know, if you study it, if you read a book about it, you'll be able to tell your friends what they are. And when you know what they are, the real value of Myers-Briggs is that it is non-judgmental. It doesn't say type A is better than type B or C. In theory, all the types are needed. They all have different strengths and different weaknesses. Every type has strengths and every type has weaknesses. But what's great about it is when you know, for example, say you have troubles with your boss and you just can't understand, you know, why is he such a jerk? You figure out his Myers-Briggs identifier and you might then understand why he operates the way he does. That's not to say you'll like it. You know, if it's a personality type that doesn't work well with yours, you're going to have constant friction. But understanding it makes you a little less angry about it, and that's a big help. So Myers-Briggs can really help in that regard. But we used to talk about this at the Retire Early Board at Motley Fool, that people who have an interest in retiring early tend to be in certain personality types. And again, you can take this too far, but I do think there's a basic truth to it. And the personality type that dominated our discussion board was the INTJ personality type. And the INTJs are very analytical. They're sort of the economist / engineer type. And they love numbers, you know, they love to do calculations, they love to analyze things, they love to plan, but they're not good with people. They're gruff, they don't listen, they're caught up in their own vision. They're rude. They're rude, okay? That would be a simple way of saying it. That's the INTJ. And they add a lot to the world. We need INTJs, okay? No question about it. Some of my best friends are INTJs, but Rob Bennett is not an INTJ. I am an INFJ, so I'm close, right? I'm close enough to get me on a retire early board, but not close enough to go along with everything that was being said at the party. Let's put it that way. INFJs, the difference there is INFJs are also analytical. But INFJs, instead of having a T, which stands for thinking, we have an F, which stands for feeling. So one is not better than the other. It's not a criticism. They're not saying INFJs don't think. You know, they're not smart. That's not what they're saying. It's how you process information. INFJs tend to interact better with other people. And If people's feathers are ruffled, an INFJ is always concerned about that. They sort of want to move in and say, oh, let's work that out and get the group all moving in the right direction and that sort of thing. INFJs tend to be teachers, you know, pastors, counselors, things of that nature. They're in the helping professions. They're every bit as smart as INTJs, okay? But they're smart in a different way. They're not as inclined to do studies, you know. That's not the idea that would occur to an INFJ. An INFJ would say, they'd give a speech, you know. They say, sit down and let's talk, you know. Whereas an INTJ would say, here's my study, that proves it. You know, end of discussion. And the world needs both. But what a lot of what has happened with me and a lot of the writing I've done, it all comes from the fact that I am an INFJ in an INTJ world. The world, this world of personal finance is a world of numbers. And people think they just come at it. There's another great example of this. This is a great example. And I can't give you the site name. I'm sorry. But there's a guy who just wrote a review of my book, Passion Saving, on his blog. And I think it might have been Richer by the Day, but I can't swear to that. I could have that wrong. But I think the guy's name was Mike. I hope I don't get these things wrong. But I'm going to write a blog, and I will link to it. And so if you go to my blog, you'll find it. Or if you do a Google search, you'll probably find it. But he just wrote this review in the last couple of days, and he did an amazing job. The guy, there were things about my book he liked, and there were things he didn't like. It was a mixed bag in terms of the review. But boy, did he work it. I was really impressed. He just went into a... He clearly read the whole book. He wasn't one of these guys that skimmed a couple pages, you know, and wrote a couple, you know, comments that anybody could have written about anything. He really dug in, and so I greatly respect him for that, and I told him so. He said something that I just thought was so perfectly funny, and he said, "I almost put this book down when I read the part where Rob's explaining why he didn't contribute anything to his 401k money, and he thought that was a good idea, his 401k plan." And, you know, that's very early in the book. That's in the beginning of chapter 2. So if he was going to put the book down then, he wasn't going to get very far. And I do have such a section. I don't know if this guy's an INTJ or not. It wouldn't surprise me. I don't know. I don't know enough about him to say, so I shouldn't say. But there are a lot of people who would react the way he did. And of course, I knew that when I told the story. The story was, I don't want to go into it, but the story was, I was in a company, and you know, there's some kind of rule where they have to get a certain amount of participation in the 401k plan. So they're often encouraging people to participate. And I was one of the higher paid people there. I was a manager. And I didn't give a penny to the 401k, you know. And this, you know, it was a very nice woman in benefits. And she, you know, she comes into my office and sits down. And she's like, "Rob, you know, and she's giving me all the advantages, which are huge. You know, there's a corporate match, and, you know, you're going to, you know, the tax benefit, and it's going to compound, you know." She's got great ammunition. And, you know, I was being perfectly nice. I said, "Yeah, those are good points. Those are good points." And she's like, "Well, will you sign this piece of paper?" I'm like, "Well, I'll think about it, you know." And all I'm thinking in my mind is, you know, if I start giving money to the 401k, what's that going to do to the money I used to go to Blues Alley? You know, this is a problem, you know. And everybody would say, "You're an idiot." And I don't think so. I think people should save more than they do. Obviously, that's why I wrote the book. But I believe that there's good reasons why young people don't save. Because young people have things they can do to improve their life through spending that are also important. And, you know, I use Blues Alley as a funny example. But the point is, if I went to Blues Alley with some woman and she ended up being the person I married, well, that's worth a lot more to me than an employer match. You know, that woman is going to change my life. She's going to be there for me when I'm sick. She's going to, you know, support me when I'm worried about something. She's going to have my children. Right? So that was important to me at the time, you know, meeting the right woman to marry. So you don't necessarily have to go to Blues Alley to do that, but it helps. And so that's where I wanted to direct my money. Anyway, I don't want to get off on that because I'll start talking forever about it. But the point here is, I told that story for a reason. What I was trying to do was put myself in the head of the non-saver. The question I address in my book is, why don't people save? I'm trying to persuade them to save. Well, you have to get into their head to persuade them to save. So I do that. And this guy who already understands why you should save, you know, he gets it. He's a fantastic saver. He's got his own blog on it. You know, he's looking at me like, You're a moron. You know, I was going to put your book in the trash. I understand the reaction, but what he's missing is I didn't write the book for him. You know, and I wrote it for somebody in a different head. And I think that's what's going on with this investing stuff. I don't write, you know, for the experts. They could take care of themselves. You know, John Bogle's made his millions. He doesn't need Rob Bennett's advice. Bill Bernstein doesn't need my advice. Jonathan Clements doesn't need my advice. The people that need my advice are the people on the discussion boards who say, Rob, I've never heard anybody make sense out of this the way you just did. I learned something, man. Thank you. That's who I'm writing for. And that's the person, unfortunately, that Bogle and Bernstein and Burns and Clements are leaving out in the cold a lot of times. Not deliberately, but they are. They may not even see it. They think a perfect example of this, Bernstein, in his book, The Four Pillars of Investing, he talks in the introduction, he talks about how this book was a rewrite, essentially, of an earlier book he had written, and he wanted it to get broader distribution, and the publisher said, if you want broader distribution, if you want us to publish it, you've got to take out those equations. Every time you put in an equation, you lose, you know, 10,000 readers or whatever it is. And Bernstein sort of, you know, he's saying this, I don't know what the word is, ruefully, you know, maybe. He's complaining about it. Not in a nasty way, but he's unhappy about it. He'd like to have the equations, is the point. He would like to include the equations in the book. Now, I understand why. I understand the value of equations. But my way of thinking about it is, I just think about the person who's going to read his book. You know, John Bogle loves equations, I'm sure, but John Bogle doesn't need to read Bernstein's book. The person who needs to read Bernstein's book is a man or a woman. They've got a job. They work 10 hours a day. They've got to take the kids to soccer practice. They've got to go to the dentist. And then, you know, maybe they get 45 minutes before they go to bed to read a book. And the last thing they want to do is pick up a book and have an equation staring back at them. So I understand, I have sympathy for Bernstein's point of view. I also have sympathy for his reader's point of view. And I tend to take the side of the reader because I'm more like the reader than I am like Bernstein. So, you know, no equations in any Rob Bennett books. I'm going to put a sticker on the front. Equation-free personal finance material. Buy it here. You know, no equations. Because Rob Bennett doesn't understand equations. So I'm not going to ask you to. I promise. You see, we're talking about people coming at this from different places, and this is a lot of the anger. You see, there's a phrase I use. I use it all the time, and maybe you'll think it's nasty, but it's not intended nasty. I use this phrase. I talk about the old school studies, and you know. John Graney is the one that was in our community, you know, that posted abusively because he didn't want people knowing he got the number wrong in his safe withdrawal rate study. So I will use this phrase, you know, Graney got the number wrong, or the old school studies get the number wrong. And they hate that. Of all the things I could say, saying they got the number wrong, because that's what they take pride in. The INTJ, they're all about, they don't care if you like them. If you say, I hate his gut, Graney wouldn't care. I know Graney one time, we were friends, you know, and one time when I started writing my book, I wanted to write it with him as co-author, and I sent him an email. I said, John, let's write a book together. And, you know, you got to love the guy. He came back and he said, Rob, I don't think that's such a good idea. He says, I'm an asshole, you know, you don't want to write a book with me. And, you know, what are you going to say? But in other words, one of the things I like about John Graney is he will say that about himself. He's not, he's not pretentious, you know. He'll just say, I'm an asshole. You know, he's quite upfront about that. And that, I like that. I find that particular element of his personality, Charming is too strong a word, but I like it. I'll say that. I find it somewhat charming. And, but, so if you say John Graney's an asshole, I don't think he really gets mad. He doesn't really, it just goes past him. Other people would get upset, you know, but he doesn't. But if you say he got the number wrong, holy moly, you know, John Graney doesn't get numbers wrong. He's a calculating machine. But the truth is, now, as I said, it's a little, perhaps I know that it upsets him. And it upsets all these people. So why do I do it? I do it because where I'm coming from, you know, how does Rob Bennett decide what to say and what not to say? I come to it from a reporter's perspective. That's how I view the world. That's what I am. I'm a journalist. I'm not an investing analyst. I'm not a financial planner. I'm a journalist. Journalists tell stories. They tell narratives. They look for scoops. They look for things nobody knows. That's what journalists do. So, to me, it's a scoop that Graney and all these other people got the number wrong. And they did. You see, they look at it as all the calculations are right. And if I've been told that once, I've been told 10,000 times. And I always agree. All their calculations are right. Of course. I never questioned it for 3 seconds. But they don't. These studies are analytically invalid. They don't include all the factors. The factor they left out, surprise, surprise, is people. Stock investing is 50% numbers, which is what these people are masters at, and 50% people. The passive investing school was not made by people who love people, okay? It was made by people who love numbers. And what they did, the efficient market theory is the academic framework. What they did was they said, let's create an imaginary world. And it will be a world that we wished we lived in. It will be a world, fellow INTJs, in which there are no people. Only warm, fuzzy, lovable, you want to take them to bed with you, numbers. That's why we just lost $8 trillion in wealth. I'm telling you the truth. I don't know if you get it, but I'm telling you the truth. People do what people are good at. And the sort of people that came up with the efficient market theory are numbers people. This is a stark objective fact. You can check it out. They won prizes because the people giving the prizes were people who love numbers. And they said, you people have done more with numbers than anybody's ever done before. You deserve a prize. Here's a prize. The reason the efficient market theory caught on like wildfire is they took investing and they reduced it to a number. And they said, hey, we can manipulate it. We can do, think of all the studies we can do. Think of all the calculators we can create. Think of all the charts. Think of all the tables. We're going to be busy for 1 million years. We're going to be kings. We're going to tell everybody how it works. And everybody's going to have to listen to us because we're the only ones that understand these equations. These dummies don't get equations. They don't read. They don't read our books. They're scared of equations. That's the story. And Rob Bennett stumbles along, dum-de-dum-dum, you know. People who love people, you know, here I am. Here I am on the scene. And, you know, I'm posting at the Retire Early Board, and these people all loved me there because they used to have a phrase. They all loved me. I was the most popular poster at the Motley Fool site. It was filled with INTJs, but they loved me. Why? I knew my place. They had a phrase they'd use to describe my stuff. They'd say, Graney loved me. You know, Graney had he put a fact, you know, a frequently asked questions thing up for newcomers. And he said, if you're new to this board, the first thing you need to do is read every post by Rob Bennett. You know, that'll tell you what it takes to retire early. So he didn't have any problem with me. But I knew my place. You know, what I used to write about was only saving, and they believed in saving, and they liked it that I could articulate things that they felt and they believed. And I was sort of the guy who wrote it down on paper. And they were like, yeah, man, you're telling the world, you're telling it right. And I brought people into the board, and that made it exciting for them to be there. That made them a little bit famous. They liked it. But I didn't write about numbers, you know. And you know, it was a mutually beneficial, you know, relationship, because I don't like numbers, and they didn't want me writing about numbers, so we all got along just great. But they used to have a phrase. They'd say, oh, Rob is the master at the soft side of early retirement. Now, they did not mean that in a nasty way at all. They meant it totally in a nice way. I always felt it was a little patronizing, not intentionally, but I always felt it was a little patronizing. You know, if I'm the soft side, well, obviously they are the hard side, and there's a suggestion there that the hard side is what counts. You know, they're the steak and potatoes. You know, I'm the dish of ice cream at the end. The soft side. And it's not inaccurate to say I'm the soft side. I write about people. I write about feelings. I write about emotions. I write about motivation. I write about connections that people might otherwise overlook. So I do write about the soft side, but from my perspective, the soft side is the most important side. And the hard side is sort of the support for the soft side. But you know, who's to say who's right? You know, God threw us all together in this world, and he expects us to work it out somehow. But there, you know, there is no definitive statement on who's right. I think the soft side's more important, but I would, wouldn't I? You know. So, but what I'm getting at here is this is a battle that's going on in the field of personal finance. And what's happened is for years and years, it was dominated by numbers people, because the trick is there's only going to be so many personal finance experts. What do people want? You know, if you took a poll of people, what do you want in a personal finance expert? What they're going to say is, I want credibility. I want reliability. I want responsibility. I want, you know, I want a guy that wears a suit and tie, you know, and doesn't have spaghetti stains on his shirt. You know, banks don't name themselves strawberry alarm clock. You know, it wouldn't be the image you want to portray. You know, rock and roll bands can name themselves strawberry alarm clock, but not banks. When money's involved, you want sturdy, you want safe, you want hard, you want real, you want tough. You want masculine, right? Isn't that a different way of saying it? Generalizations are always dangerous. There are obviously women who are tough and strong, and there are obviously men who are weak and soft. But as a generalization, the types of things that work as a personal finance advisor are masculine. And so it is. Most people in the field are men. And most are INTJ men, not, you know, there are other personality types that are similar to INTJs, so it's not just INTJs. But most are in that school. Most are in that family of personalities. So I think it's a big deal that we've now got some women in the field. And I am not a woman, but see, the INFJ is it's a personality. It's a collection of personality traits that has both masculine and feminine angles to it. As I say, the INJ part comes off very masculine. You know, I fit right in. I am close enough to the other so-called experts, so-called personal finance experts, to understand what they're saying and to be able to debate with them. You know, to have an interest in money. I'm close enough, But I've got this F, and the INFJ is a very rare personality trait. I think this is important here. It's 1% of the population. It's a very, especially among men. It's particularly rare among men. And so the F pulls me to the feminine side of the spectrum of personality traits. So I have some of the feminine virtues. I don't like it. I don't like abusive posting, you know? I am offended by it. I don't like hearing people mocked and ridiculed. I want them to speak. You know, when somebody gets ridiculed, I want to say to the goons, shut up. And, you know, that's sort of a masculine, the feminine way might be to say, be quiet, you see. But I'm masculine enough, I don't say be quiet, I say shut up. I come on strong, but the desire is that peace. And then I go to the person who's been intimidated and I say, what you said was interesting. Could you expand on that? I think we all would learn from that. See, that's the feminine. That's the feminine side coming out. And there's just not much of this in personal finance today. So this is the, you know, again, as a reporter, I see this as a niche to be developed. It's what excites me about my work. That when it catches on big. When I connect with somebody, I form a deep connection because they've never heard it before. And what I think is going on in investing, in a nutshell, is what I found at every board at which I have ever participated is lots of people asking me questions, lots of people interested in what I have to say. The rational investing school, let's call it. But then there's this group of like 10 or 20% of the board committee community, which I call the know-it-alls. And they hate what I have to say with a burning passion. And they're threatened by it. They've established themselves. They're at the top in the hierarchy. And this 80% is not at the top. And the 80% doesn't care to be in the top. They're just there to learn. They don't care about board politics. But this 10 or 20%, they're at the top. They're the kings. And they don't want their kingship questioned. And I never intended to question it that wasn't my intent. But when I say their studies are wrong, in their mind I'm questioning their kingship. Well, we're only kings because we got the numbers right, and if we don't get the numbers right, we're finished, we're losers. To them, that I really think that's how they see it. If they got the studies wrong, they're losers. I don't see it that way. Again, this is the feminine side coming out. The feeling side, let's call it. The big thing that always comes up is, you know, I say, why is it such a big deal to admit a mistake? Because I've made mistakes. When I wrote my book, Passion Saving, I sent it to John Walter Russell to read. I said, John, you know, please check it out. Tell me if you see it. And he found a mistake. And, you know, surprise, surprise, it was on the calculation of a number. And I said, you know, thanks, man, because it would be embarrassing to print up the book and then have this error in it. So he saved me that. So I never gave a thought to thinking that was a bad thing. I was thrilled. But I get this all the time on the safe withdrawal rate issue. Michael Kitsis, in my correspondence with him, I said, Michael, you know, the numbers are wrong in these studies. Millions of people are going to suffer busted retirements. No, that's a statement I make all the time. Notice my focus. People. Millions of people. That's how I look at the world. Michael, millions of people are going to suffer. I don't say, Michael, look at this equation. Don't you see, just looking at that equation, that this is wrong? I don't look at it. I look at it. Millions of people are going to suffer busted retirements. What does Michael say? He says, well, Rob, you're right. A lot of people are going to suffer. That's true. He acknowledged that. But then he says, but I don't want to disrespect somebody else's study. I don't want to disrespect. This makes my mind want to explode. Why is it considered disrespectful to point out that somebody got something wrong? I do not see it that way. I see it as, I would want somebody to tell me I got something wrong. I wouldn't want to get stuff wrong. So I'd be thrilled if they did that. And of course, I would be thrilled from learning, and I could go to the next step in my understanding of the issue. So many of these issues are how you come at them. And so when I tried to describe to Michael, circling back to the beginning of the podcast, when I tried to describe to Michael the new model, the rational investing model, well, rational investing, it's not a new equation. I didn't solve some super hard equation. That's not what I did. What I did was I said, hey, honey, we forgot the people. That's what all of this is about. What investing is two things. It's half numbers and it's half people. And valuations, whenever I say, you know, you always hear me talking about valuations. Valuations affect long-term returns. Valuations is the people part. That's the part of investing that is determined by human emotions. That's where people come into the picture. And what these efficient market theory guys do is they don't like people. I mean, obviously they have friends and things like that. I don't want to take it too far, but they're not easy with people. People make them sort of queasy. It's not their favorite thing to talk about. You know, if you started talking hugs and kisses, you know, it's squishy stuff to them. They don't go for it. These are the kind of guys that would they'd be hardworking husbands, loyal, honest, you know, true, but they never remember your birthday. You know, this is the kind of guy they would be. You know, I'm just saying, you know, love them or, you know, don't love them, whatever you want to do, but that's what they are. You might as well accept them because that's what they are. And so what they did when they made this efficient market theory is they said, here are all the numbers that affect investing. And they got all that right. But they left out valuations, which is the people part. And it never occurred to them that they were leaving something out. It just skips right past their eyes. Whereas for me, it the first time I ever looked at one of those old school studies, I was like, what? Aren't you leaving something out? So one of the things that goes on when Wayne says, well, your description is vague. I don't want to give. A lot of people come to me and they want the bottom line. You see, again, this is a male way to think about things. What's the bottom line? Tell me what to do. I had a guy at a party tell me that. He says, I know how to make your website a huge success. Just on the front page, tell people what to do. You know, instructions. Very simple, very short. That's what people want. And the man is right. I see it all the time. People love that stuff. Tips, you know? 10 tips for better kissing, you know? I think it is so idiotic. But that's, people love this stuff. But I'm betraying myself if I reduce rational investing to 10 tips. It's not about tips. It's about what I'm always trying to describe is the why question. Why does rational investing work? Why does passive investing not work? Why does rational investing work? But the why, of course, takes time. You have to explore it. It can't be reduced to a tip or a number. It takes time. It's a conversation. That's why I like doing blogs. I can explain this better in a conversation than in a tip. But it frustrates what people are expecting in personal finance is, I want my tip list. You mean I got to listen to, you know, 63 minutes of this guy to figure out his point? And they want to blow their brains out. They want to put the book down like the guy at the, you know, the blog writing about my book. But I love telling those stories about not contributing to the 401k plan. So what I'm trying to say is, rational investing is not a finished product. We're developing it all the time. But I don't believe it's ever going to be a collection of equations or tips. It's always going to be about, there's always going to be narrative there. We certainly do numbers and we do calculators to guide people because you just have to do that. But the calculator's never going to give you the final answer. Never. I don't think it ever can. I can't tell you. You know, I can tell you the PE10 level today is 15. I can tell you stocks offer a strong long-term value proposition at today's prices. I can't tell you what your stock allocation can be, should be. I can give you ideas. You know, I'll do a separate podcast and I'll go through. You know, if you're age 20, it should be such and such. And, you know, if you're trying to retire early, it should be such and such. And, you know, I can go on and on. If you're willing to wait 5 years, it should be such and such. If you're willing to wait 10, it's this. I can give you all those considerations, but I can't reduce it to a tip, because that's a betrayal of the core idea of rational investing. What makes it rational is that it's the investing model that integrates the numbers and the emotions. That's why it's rational. The theory is passive investing is the model that denies human emotion. Passive investors will say, don't be emotional. But their way of doing that is to deny that they have emotions. And I say that's the worst thing you can do. When you deny your emotions, they go underground. They come up at the worst time and destroy you. I'm saying the way to tackle your emotions, the way to rein in your negative emotions, is to acknowledge them and cope with them. But see, I can't reduce that to an equation. I have to give you a narrative. So this is a more feminine approach to investing than what you are used to. And I think there are a lot of people out there who need to hear that and who actually like it. But they are quiet. They are not the people who enter investing terms into Google, into a Google search box. So it's hard for them sometimes to find my website. But when I connect with them, I get a strong connection, you know, and I hear this from people, and every time I hear it, it encourages me to continue to explore this aspect of the question. Valuations are people. That's what valuations are. That's what the passive investing model left out. That's what the rational investing model includes. And what I am arguing is that if we're going to fix investing so that we don't get $8 trillion losses for middle-class investors over 12-month time periods, we're going to need to hear more of a feminine voice among investing analysts. That's what I believe. That's why I say, are you woman enough for rational investing? You need to be open to letting your feminine, caring, story-oriented side come forward, and to, you know, not to lose your number-crunching, male, analytical side, but to play that down a bit. The ultimate goal is to integrate the two in a marriage. That's what I think works for the long-term stock investor. Good luck with your investing strategy. Take care.